KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear this show at KCRW.com. When we think of what used to be called peak TV, I guess it's now just really good television, shows such as Mad Men or Top of the Lake or The Handmaid's Tale come to mind. And what these shows all have in common, and a lot of other really good things too, such as movies by Alex Ross Perry, is my guest, Elizabeth Moss, who's starring in and producing the FX series, The Veil. First of all, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm a fan of yours and this podcast, so I'm excited to be here.
So often in these things that we talk about, you're playing characters who are keeping a bit of a secret. They're keeping some parts of themselves away from us. And I'm wondering what it is that attracts you so often to characters like that who are keeping parts of themselves hidden away.
I think it's just as simple as you never want to play one thing, right? So as an actor, you're always looking for the duality. You're always looking for what's on the surface and what's inside. And so material where your character actually has a secret, or where your character actually has a hidden life or something they're not saying, just makes that much easier, you know? So I think it's just because for me, I've always want to be playing more than one thing at the same time. That to me is more interesting.
I think it's interesting too, because when we first meet your character Imogen in the Veil, in this first episode of the show, she smiles so much that we don't know what to make of it. She's almost using the smile as a way to disarm people and to sort of keep herself detached from everything. And would you talk about that? Because I thought it was a really interesting acting choice for this introduction to the character.
This character was so interesting because right off the bat, the first conversation I had with Steve Knight, he described the character and he described what it was like to be a spy, and he described her as a spy and all of this stuff, and how she plays 100 different people. And when she's lying, she's not really lying. She's actually being her most honest self and all of this stuff. And he went on this whole thing. It was brilliant. He's a beautiful speaker. I don't know if you've ever spoken to him. He's beautiful. And at the end, I was like, oh, so she's an actor, Steve. And he was like, yeah, that's right. I said, okay, great. Well, I know what that looks like. And I tell that story because for me, that was just with the different people that Imogen plays, it was very organic for me to try to figure out different ways that she would act and different things that she would do that weren't actually herself. And I don't even know if Imogen knows necessarily who herself is. And obviously more about that will be revealed in the finale, but it was a conscious choice, yes, to have the Imogen that you first meet in episode one, not that you first meet, actually the one that you second meet, the one who meets Adila, our other female lead, is just trying to do her best. She's a do-gooder. She's an NGO worker. She's personable and she's charming, and you know, she's just trying to put everyone at ease. And she's one of those people that just is there to try to help and make a difference in the world. You'll come to learn that that's very much not the real Imogen.
No, it's interesting you say real, because so much of what I think of she's doing is she's playing honesty in the moment. Yeah. And I think that's why it doesn't feel like lying to her, because each moment for her is about, what do I need to do at this particular time to get through this moment and convince the person I'm talking about? Because that's her skill, is that she can draw people out, which is an unusual skill, because you're so used to seeing espionage figures in movies and TV who are good with their fists and just sort of break everything. And her gift and her mission is to be able to get information from people.
Exactly. And to be able to make them trust her and believe that she's telling the truth. And what you just said is exactly right about being honest in the moment. And for me, that's acting. Like, I hate when people say actors are really good liars. It's probably true, and I understand what they mean. But to me, I don't consider it lying when I'm acting, because you're actually trying to be the most honest and truthful you could possibly be. I mean, that's what it's all about, right? In the moment, you're trying to tell as much truth as possible. So I think that's what Imogen is so good at. She might be fudging the details about exactly what she does for a living, but she truly is really interested in who this woman is. And that's honest. She is not lying about that. And Adila can feel that.
It's interesting, too, because I think about so many of these characters that you have played and these chameleon-like qualities. I can't help but think, in watching Imogen, of think of The Handmaid's Tale and how she had to be able to sort of switch characters and shut off part of herself, too. But it was more immediate just to get through a day and not have her psyche fall apart.
Yeah, exactly. It's a certain amount of control, I think, that both of the characters have. And June and Handmaids definitely had to develop in Gilead this ability to control your thoughts, control your face, your emotions, obviously control what you say in the sense of not saying anything. Yeah, there's a certain amount of acting going on there as well, isn't there? Maybe I'm just playing actors. That's my big trick. I'm just playing an actor every time.
Hey, like they say, do what you do best. Do what you know. It's the treatment. We're talking about truth versus honesty with my guest, Elizabeth Moss. She's starring in and producing the series, The Veil, for FX. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/the treatment. But I think there's a fascinating physicality to these characters to me, because as we're talking about Handmaid's Tale or here in The Veil, I'm really aware of the physical control these women exert to sort of make other people feel calm around them versus what you did in Top of the Lake, where she was really not in control of her body so much and her body gave her away even when she was saying something different.
Huh. That's such an interesting observation. I didn't even realize that was happening. I used to dance. I used to be a dancer, ballet for many, many years. And I think the biggest thing I've taken from that into my actual career is just like body awareness and being able to use your body and your physicality to help tell the story. And the way that you sit and the way that you stand and the way that you walk and just the way that you fidget or the way that you don't fidget is so helpful in any performance. You know, Peggy on Mad Men was really still, which is probably something like no one noticed, but to me, I knew she was very, very still and she held herself in this very, very sort of like still way.
She almost held herself like a dancer. She had almost a dancer's posture. Her shoulders were back, her hands were in front of her.
That's exactly right. And if you remember, Matt wrote into the script, or someone wrote into the script from the writer's room, I should say, that someone, I think it was Freddie, called her, Joel Murray's character called her ballerina, because she had that kind of that posture. So anyway, it's not really conscious because I'm not a very conscious actor. I'm very much more instinctive, but I do tend to naturally sort of figure out some kind of physicality to the character that's different, but it's not really thought out. Like the Top of the Lake thing, I was like, no idea I did that.
I think of you as being a really physical actor, and I'm aware of the way, for example, that Imogen inhabits spaces, that when we first see her, when that thing that's almost like out of a dream at the beginning of the first episode. She's really in control and she walks in very confidently because she wants to make this person she's going to meet with confident about her before the rug is pulled out from under everybody. I'm just fascinated watching the way your physicality is so much a part of these characters.
It's not necessarily conscious in the sense of, now I'm going to play this character with this kind of physicality. It just instinctively, I can't help but use my entire body, I think, because of the ballet background. I can see Jane Campion. I can see her being highly aware of that and not saying anything to me. You know, she's obviously a brilliant director. And I can see her seeing something and seeing me do something physically and then never saying a word to me about it. You know, that would be very Jane.
You're talking about being conscious versus instinct. And that's the battle that this character has in the show, isn't it? She's talking about trusting her instinct versus being conscious about this world she's been pushed into. And I just, it's fascinating. You're talking about these as being acting choices. And it's also the way that Imogen has to sort of lead life versus career.
I mean, that's why when Steve and I first spoke about it, I wanted to work with him, and I loved this two scripts that I had read. But after the conversation with him, which was about an hour long, I was pacing around my neighborhood in Toronto where I was shooting Handmaids, and everything he was saying, I could just really connect with, because it just sounded like what I think acting is. It sounded like what I think trying on different characters is, you know, and trying to constantly balance being aware and conscious. As a producer and a director, sometimes you're very aware and conscious when you're acting, but also having to be instinctive and forget about that and just follow your instincts. And yes, that's why I think Imogen, this particular kind of spy, was so fascinating to me. And so I felt so connected to the idea of what she was trying to do. I understood it.
I think it's a show that demands to be seen several times, just because there is so much emotional information that we're getting in that we realize, and I did have a chance to sort of get through a second time. You want to go back just to sort of get a bigger sense of the landscape. And there are things that fascinate me, like in the first episode, the way she uses lighting a cigarette to sort of really set the temperature of the room and see how people are going to react to her and draw her in. And I thought that was a really great thing for you to have to play, but also the way it takes up the room and the way she takes up space. I really like that, because it's a personal moment, but also about manipulation too.
That was a conscious thing. That wasn't instinctive. That was something. That was something I wanted to. Originally, I think she smoked, I think throughout the whole show, I think she was a smoker. And I liked the idea that it was part of this character that she was playing in the beginning of the show. Exactly. It was to kind of disarm, but also kind of maybe push a button and show that she's confident, show that she doesn't care, show that she doesn't, you know, she's going to do her own thing, and allow through the tension that brings development of this, you know, this relationship with this other woman. And people often say, oh, well, Imogen smokes. And I would say, no, she never smokes past, I think, the second episode. The only time she smokes on her own is in the first time you see her. But past that, she never smokes without Adila around. And it's just those like little things that were so fun to play with and very actory. I sound very actory right now, which makes me cringe a little bit. But you get what I mean.
This character takes up space in a very specific way. And it's about being seen and drawing attention to herself and then stepping back and speaking to the other person. That's a very aggressive thing to light a cigarette. And, you know, most places everywhere now, not just in the Western world, when you light up, people kind of go, ew. But for her to do that and then sort of talk after that, I mean, it's not, because usually that's used as kind of a device to just sort of say, this is a really sort of aggressive or maybe thoughtless person. But with her, it's a way for her to get to know the other person she's in the room with. I mean, she does it when she first walks in to go online, presumably because she's going to talk to her mother. So she does it a few times to really get a sense of who people are. And I just thought, again, there are so many details like that in this show.
There's very few accidents in this show. It's very well thought out and well planned. And you mentioned Alex Ross Perry, like sometimes you'll see something and it is just, you fly through the day and you just are making things up and it's super fun. And then there are projects like this where it is very methodical. We had all six scripts to start with, so we knew exactly where we were going and everything was very, very, very thought out and planned. And yeah, the smoking thing is, whether it's a good interaction or a bad interaction, it's a way for her to connect with somebody. Either they're going to ask for a cigarette, they can bum one, or they're going to say, stop smoking, that's disgusting. But either way, she's established a communication with the person in the room. And it's a total tactic.
It is. If you're thinking, shut up, you're not thinking about my guest, Elizabeth Moss. You're probably thinking of me. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're in the smoking section of The Treatment. My guest is Elizabeth Moss. She's starring in The Veil on FX. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/The Treatment. My guest, you mentioned Alex Ross Perry before the break. And what I like so much about those movies is, unlike these characters who are so often wrapped in enigma and maybe even keeping things from themselves, in those movies, you get to play these women who are totally exposed, who in a lot of cases are just these raw nerves or women trying to hold their lives together.
I love working with him so much, and we're due to work together again. I have to start bugging him again. Basically, I bug him every few years and just say, "Have you written anything yet?" And then I make him go write something for me. But it's so fun working with him, not only because he's a great filmmaker, but it just is so free, and it's so unselfconscious. And yes, these women are so exposed, and he allows me to go places that I don't really get to go anywhere else. And we just, I mean, find things all day. And there've been so many moments that we never in a million years would have planned that are in one of the movies we made, you know, together. And we have a bit of a game where I kind of challenge him to write something every time that is harder, like write me something harder to do. Write me something you think I cannot do. I constantly am asking him to challenge me. It's really fun.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny you're saying that, because those characters, I'm thinking about certainly Her Smell, but also in Queen of Earth, are characters who challenge other people around them, not intentionally, but their very existences are challenges to the people who try to live around them.
Yeah, and they're not necessarily like quote unquote likable people, you know? Oh. I mean,
Even ironically, are they likable?
Exactly. Not even like, they have their good qualities. Like that was so fun about Becky in Her Smell, which was probably the furthest that we went in that direction, because I mean, she was just awful and there were no redeeming qualities to her. And she was just kind of a terrible person and a terrible mom and a terrible wife and friend. It was really fun to like care at all about whether or not the audience was connecting with her, you know, to just not care at all and just go as far as possible in that direction. And it wasn't easy. I would say like that was probably the hardest, most challenging role I've ever done in my life. But at the same time, one of the reasons why it was the most challenging was the dialogue. And as free as we were with Her Smell, we found really early on that if you didn't say the words exactly as written, it didn't work.
Really?
Yeah, it was really interesting. So you had to be like super free and super big and be able to do whatever you wanted and blah, blah, blah. But if you change the words, it didn't work. And we found that out like the first week. And I was like, oh, darn, now I have to really learn these lines.
That's so funny, because she's such an intrusive, elbows out kind of character who only cares about what she perceives to be her art. I remember in seeing that, I thought this would actually make a great play, because every room she was in became claustrophobic. Do you know what I mean? Like she took up too much space.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You're absolutely right. It would have been a great play. And the way that we shot it was like that, you know, all five acts were in the script as five acts. And it was actually, I believe he was inspired by Shakespeare. He had seen some Shakespeare recently. I can't remember what exactly he had seen, but he had seen some Shakespeare recently in some other theater. And I think that the five act structure that kind of inspired him to write that Her Smell. And each act was also, you know, it said in the script how it was going to be shot and the colors. So it'd be like handheld and red. So it was very planned out in that way. Like a play. And we had the five different, you know, sets or four different sets. And, but yeah, we found out that you had to say all of the words exactly as written. And so everything she says is Alex wrote. That's all in the script.
As you're saying this, you remind me, and then when I watched it again, we know what she wants at all times. And I guess that kind of, I don't want to say clarity, because there's so much chaos there, but that kind of specificity would have to be written.
It's the specificity of it that has to be there, because she looks like she's going off in 100 directions at once, but she's actually not. And she's very, very smart. And her references are really specific. Her cultural references are really specific. So we found that if I went off script, it didn't work anymore. And you had to stick to her mind, which was actually very specific.
For me, that character connected in some ways to Jane Campion, whose work is very much atmospheric, but also about somebody trying to sift through chaos. And a lot of the work you've done with Alex Ross Perry, certainly Queen of Earth, is about that kind of chaos being created too. And I think as viewers, the fascination is to find out where there's order in all that chaos. And it comes from that kind of specificity of character you're talking about.
Jane said the probably truest thing I've ever heard about the way that I like to work or how I work best as an actor. She described it as that I like very clear, specific box drawn that I can play in. These are my parameters. This is the situation. This is the scene. This is the room. And it's very clear and very specific. And there's not a lot of wiggle room. But then within that box, I like to be allowed to do whatever I want and have be totally free. And she described me to me one day like that. And I was like, well, Jane, that's exactly right. I mean, you've spoken to her. She's one of the most astute, you know, women. I mean, she's just one of the reasons why she's such a brilliant director and writer is because she can see people, you know, she really can see people. Anyway, to your point, I think that that does bleed into kind of the characters I like to play and the kind of projects I like to do where there is chaos, but there's order to the chaos and specificity to it, you know?
And again, going back to the veil, because I was even thinking about this, how in a lot of ways, these two women are kind of mirrors of each other. You know, they're both sort of hiding things. We think we know them both. And it turns out there are things about both of them that we don't know, that we're finding out more and more about them. And there is that chaos that surrounds both of them. There's a great scene at the beginning of the second episode that's one of my favorites in the show, where there's an argument and we think it's life or death, and it turns out to be about something that's not life or death, that actually circles back around and does turn out to be about life and death. And that's all the things we're talking about. You know, what seems to be chaotic, there's order, but there's still chaos anyway.
I'm glad you remembered that scene, because that's pure Steve. That's totally Steve Knight. That's one of those things that it's kind of weird and you're like, why are they talking about this and why are they arguing about this? But yes, you discover that there's definite deeper meaning to why that scene exists. And that strange sense of humor that Steve has is so present there. That's very Steve, that organized chaos too, isn't it? I mean, that kind of being able to have very human characters, messy characters, flawed characters, but within a structure that writing-wise actually really works to tell a story.
We're talking about order and chaos with my guest, Elizabeth Moss. She's the star and one of the producers. In fact, it comes from her company of the series The Veil, which is on FX. You can also hear this show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But I also want to go back to that first scene, that scene so meticulous and pristine, and is about betrayal and thinking you know somebody, is mirrored throughout the show. In every episode, there's kind of a scene like that. And I wonder if that was one of the things that you gravitated towards this too, that there is this precision in the what seems to be chaos in the show.
Absolutely. I definitely gravitated towards that. And also the fact that the story and the characters change every episode, you know, so you can start with scene one, episode one, and think that that's what the show is going to be about. And that's the woman you're going to see in the next scene. And it's not. Now she's somebody else. And then it will happen again in episode, you know, two. It happens again in episode three. And both of them keep changing and more comes out and more develops about their characters in each episode. And of course, that sounds like something that should happen. And why wouldn't that happen? But it doesn't always happen, you know? It doesn't. And so when you see that on the page and you see that coming from your writer, you get very excited because you know that, oh, I have, you know, in 3 months down the line, I have this whole other thing to play. And that's going to be so fun to do. And given the nature of the story of these two women, the fact that they are playing this game of truth and lies, it really lends itself to them constantly morphing and constantly developing in characters. And I mean, Yim Namarwan just does an amazing job of that as well in Adila. She's such a find.
Gosh, because we're just talking about words here, and I just flashed on this thing that you probably hear all the time, but clearly you're attracted to working with writers who have a really strong sense of where character lives. You know, from Aaron Sorkin to Jane Campion to Matt Weiner to Alice Ross Perry to Stephen Knight to the work on Handmaid's Tale. You're clearly attracted to these writers who can voice character in a way that almost feels like a little bit of a card trick, that we think we're like getting these things that are just solely about character, but in fact there's a really organized narrative that these characters are a part of, and we get lost in them. And that's been this thing that for me connects so much what you do both as a film actor and a TV actor.
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of just takes back to what we were talking about first, is that duality. Like, I think that it's not interesting really watching anything else. It's not really very interesting watching a one-dimensional character. So most good writing, most good filmmaking or television making is going to be involving characters that have more than one thing to say and more than one thing to do, you know? So it's never conscious on my part, for sure. I mean, West Wing was a job that I got, you know, I wanted to get the job for sure, but it was also a job that I needed to get. And same with Mad Men. I wanted the job. I loved the script and I wanted to play that character, but I also needed a job. So they were not conscious choices. It was just a matter of good characters that I understood and had that duality that we talked about.
And I love what you were saying about working with Alex. To the naked eye, it could feel like it's incredibly improvised. That's fascinating to hear that her smell really was there on the page. And that's what we want to hear, because when the words are that strong and that potent and the character is that well drawn, then you get to give it life in a way that must surprise you. And in her smell, we could see the surprise in that. It's almost like watching a kid shocking people by saying things.
She's definitely very childlike. an out of control, misbehaving child. Yeah, I've always had a tremendous respect for writers and the words on the page. I kind of grew up, so to speak, in that landscape more than anything else, with Aaron Sorkin and then Matt Weiner and a bit of David Mamet on Broadway. And I've kind of developed a career always having an idea, not in the improv world, you know, which I have so much respect for. It's terrifying to me.
Really?
That, oh my God, yeah. The what they do is just, I don't, it's absolutely mind-boggling to me how people just make things up and they're brilliant and so funny. I have so much respect for it. But for me, I very much rely on what's on the page, and I very much rely on what the writer has written. Doesn't mean we don't want to change it or we don't want to work on it or maybe try something else, but I'm not a person who just kind of likes to come into a room and really like wing it in a scene. I do like to have that structure. And I think I've always had a great respect for the writer's words because of just, honestly, starting with Aaron.
We're out of time. Please come back and do this again. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I apologize for being so actory. It'll never happen again.
My guest is Elizabeth Moss. She's starring. Her latest project is The Veil on FX. Thanks again for doing this, really. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. We'll speak to you soon.
She's grown from being a supporting player to an Emmy-winning star, producer, and co-creator. Elizabeth Moss serves all those functions on her new FX series, The Veil. Creators build projects for themselves and others at the archive, kcrw.com/thetreatment. Creativity abounds. It's The Treatment. More to come.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I think one of the most interesting things to say about my guest, Diarra Kilpatrick, is that she's mastered that ground that lies for Black people between irony and empathy. We can see it in her terrific web series, American Coco, and you can see bits of it in her incredible performance in the HBO series Perry Mason, or the way she looked at her husband as he's going out in 1920s Los Angeles. You knew that she wanted him to survive. We see that same need for survival in her series on BET Plus, Diarra from Detroit. My guest, Diarra Kilpatrick, is also from Detroit. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to chat with you.
At some point in every episode, there's a moment where she says something like reminds us of what it's like to see a Black person in a horror situation. In every single episode of the show. And that just struck me as being so on point and funny and kind of tragicomic at the same time.
You know, it was important, I think, to us keeping the story grounded. To be frank, people, you know, at the studio level and producers were curious if a Black audience would embrace a dark comedy. And I thought that was so ironic because I think the Black experience is a dark comedy. So I'm like, what? Why wouldn't we embrace it? Maybe it's too close to what we're living. I wasn't sure. But in all those conversations, it became clear that we really had to acknowledge the fact that the character Diarra was engaging in what we started to call Karen-like behavior, which was like, I need answers. I'm an amateur detective who needs answers. And that wasn't specifically something that Black women are normally do in life and certainly aren't allowed to do, you know, on screen very often.
But it's also, too, it's that sort of question or that condition that as Black audiences we all think of when we see Black people in horror movies, that usually Black people leave before things get bad. So to see a Black person in a bad situation, also, it triggers that thing of, will you survive? Because so often when we see Black people in those situations, they're the first to go. So there are so many things that you do in those scenes in each episode that provoke so many questions for Black audiences that for me, and I'm sure for lots of people, it deepens our engagement with the material.
Well, I love hearing that for sure.
But I think, you know, I mean, just because as an audience member, there's just things we're not used to seeing. Like, you know, seeing a Black woman drive a mystery narrative. I have a mystery narrative that asks questions about Black identity so often. That thing I said about what you do, I think, I certainly saw in American Coco and here, because there is an intersection between irony and empathy, because Black people thought of it as being either one or the other, and that we can be both, that there's complexity in that, is something that this show and what you do, I think, is about.
Absolutely. I mean, I love the way you articulated that, but I like to think about the duality of things in this character. And I think in my characters in general is that it's not just either or, which is often how we're portrayed because we need to drive the narrative, you know? So we kind of have to be that one thing, supportive, challenging, you know, strong, victimized, you know, because that's what's going to drive the narrative. But I think when we allow Diarra to drive the narrative, then she gets to be both really strong and really vulnerable and really discerning and really naive, you know, so she gets to have all of that. And that has been really exciting for me to play as an actor. And I think it's been exciting for people to watch. At least that's the feedback I'm getting on Twitter, which I'm still calling Twitter. And I know it's not called Twitter anymore.
That's okay. If we can show our age any way we want to, that's okay.
Exactly.
But I think what's really so great about this show is that it's both playful and sincere at the same time. That thing you were talking about, which is, I'm sure, a note that you got, which is that the Black experience is either about either being detached and making fun of something or being overly earnest, and that it can't support, you know, two conflicting kinds of thought or emotional states of being.
Yeah, I've really had to analyze myself, you know, as people are talking about that and trying to describe the tone and coming to that crossroads a lot. It's really the intersection of my parents. You know, my father is so silly. He's so playful. I say it's never too soon to make a joke for him. He's Black Twitter before Black Twitter. And my mother, you know, she had just this incredible depth. Everything was a lesson. Everything was a teaching opportunity. She never shied away from exploring sort of the harsher realities of life. I remember one time I said to her, we should go on a vacation. We should go on a trip. And she said to me, oh, there's this lynching museum down south we should go to. And I'm like,
Mom, that's not a vacation.
Like, do they have a margarita bar at the Lynching Museum? Otherwise, I am so not interested for the killer weekend. But I just think that the cross-section of them is kind of at the heart of a lot of what I do.
Well, you certainly are both your parents. But there's also this thing that I think you're interested in that we don't really often see in something that's played for both drama and comedy, which is the absurdity of Black life.
I find pretty much everything to be absurd. To be honest, I find most people, most situations. I realize I'm learning about myself because some of the things that I write, I didn't always think were funny. It was just like, that's how people seem to me. Like, I don't even know how to explain it better than that, than just most people are absurd to me.
Did it help that you had Kenya Barrison to help with your pitch with this? Because, I mean...
Speaking of which...
Yes, exactly.
Listen, Kenya is so prolific. And I think he was really smart at the beginning when he was like, you really have to, as much as possible, ground this story. And I think, you know, in a lot of our casting choices and, you know, at the very beginning, it really did help and was the smart move because we were going to go to such, you know, absurd places that it really helped to sort of ground it and put the audience in our back pocket that way. But yeah, it was really great for him to amplify my voice and to say, I love Diarra's writing and I want to get behind, you know, her stories.
Yeah, it must have helped too that he, in some ways, it kind of broke ground in doing this. But again, it's still done in a comic circumstance rather than a dramatic circumstance. Now, I guess I find myself thinking of Diarra from Detroit as much kind of an absurdist drama. It's like, almost like Black Chekhov to me.
It's so funny. I did a play called Three Sisters After Chekhov, which was the story of three sisters, but set in Trinidad in 1941. And that was like one of my absolute favorite things to dig into as an actor. So I'm a fan and I will certainly receive that.
But, you know, I mean, that there's a few, we go back to Three Sisters then, you know, they're just wanting to get everything they wanted to do is about trying to get outside of Moscow. And we think about, they probably weren't that far from Moscow, getting out of Moscow in the first place. And just how claustrophobic it all seemed. And there's this sort of, this incredible sort of claustrophobia, I think, or rather close circumstances. Everything, the walls get closer and closer in every episode of Diarra from Detroit for me.
Yeah, and some of that was sort of creativity being born out of the budget. You know, we had to do this 7, which is a lot of people's favorite episode, but we had to do a bottle episode. And it is interesting what comes out when you have those limits of production. Yeah, I think putting all the characters together in tight quarters was really such a great tool to have all the revelations of the show kind of come out.
It's the treat. My guest is the multi-hyphenate star and creator of Diarra from Detroit, Diarra Kilpatrick. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. You were saying something that really clicked for me. You're talking about the way you were casting and wanting to make sure that all these characters were felt in this claustrophobic atmosphere. And one of the things I like about this show is it's so richly written and acted that it's that rare circumstance you feel like you want every character to have their own story, their own episode. You're talking about bottled episodes. And there's not a single character in this I can't think of who doesn't deserve their own episode.
You're not the first person to say that. Our post producer said that too. He said, there's not a throwback in the bunch. And I think that's just my love for the people of Detroit. And even in those kind of small characters, you know, there's a guy on the bus who is a professor of nothing and everything. And I mean, that character, you know, who has these wild conspiracy theories, like I could watch a whole show about him, you know, as well.
But there is, and for all so many of these characters, and this really, it feels like Detroit in that way to me, there's this bravura and this, I'm going to be heard no matter what I say in every single character. That's got to come from the casting as well as the writing, because it's so voice specific, not just literal voice, but character voice specific, that it feels like Detroit to me.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about this a lot about, you know, coming from all of Detroit, you know, we talked about me growing up in Calumet Townhomes, which was a Section 8 housing community. But at the same time, my dad would pick me up on a Saturday and he would run a lot of campaigns in the city. Or
we should say you come from a very politically well-connected family, a legendary family in Detroit. And there is this thing, too, you were just getting it. I'm sorry I cut you up. I'm so excited to talk to you about living in two worlds at once that the show is really about.
yeah, it goes back to that duality and hanging out in Calumet on the weekends and, I mean, during the week. And then on the weekend, going to a party with my dad and meeting the governor and taking pictures and doing a whole thing. And so for me, I always felt like I could go anywhere. I could go into any world. And then I also never quite felt like I was organic to any world. So I did a lot of observing, you know, and I think that a lot of what I write is kind of course, it's not a documentary. There's a lot of imagination.
I hope not.
Right. But it is married, you know, to a lot of truths and to a lot of sort of well-observed people and moments that I've seen or experienced or heard about in Detroit.
There's one episode that involves taking Molly and dealing with a Russian gangster that set in a rave in Royal Oak that has one of the great lines about Royal Oak that I will not give away and won't make sense unless you step across 8 Mile into Royal Oak. But that's why I think the show is so great, Diarra, because it really is about how these different worlds are right on top of each other. They're not millions of miles away or even other time zones away. They're constantly pushing against each other. And that's why I said claustrophobia. These worlds are sort of exploding onto each other, onto each other, onto each other.
Yeah, I think that is what it is to be in Detroit, in the Detroit area. It's worlds on top of worlds on top of worlds, all existing in one place. And that's in Detroit. That's also in Hollywood too. You know, being out here in LA, there's extreme poverty and extreme wealth and abundance literally right on top of each other. And all that is really interesting to me.
But I think there's that kind of complexity is not often assigned to Detroit. I mean, even when people write about it or do things about it, that it's so many different things because there's such an archetypal expectation of what Detroit is. And I'm sure we both encounter whenever you tell somebody they're from Detroit and there's that gasp of.
Yeah. They're always like, are you okay? What happened? Do you need to talk? Can I give you a hug? Yeah. It's really funny to me because it's the place where I've known the most warmth, the most love, you know. And I always say, you know, somebody got their first kiss in Detroit, got married in Detroit. You know, there's romance, there's softness, there's love there. It's not just, you know, whatever, it was the murder capital of the world at some point.
There is this kind of incredible thing that I thought, which is about every area, every part of Detroit, and there's these references to the East Side, which is its own place in Detroit. And the topography of the city creates its own kind of constituency. And the show's also about that too. Each part of the city, be it downtown or Royal Oak or the East Side, which also goes on forever too, it has its own kind of almost its own language and its own citizenry. And I think the show is really smart and specific about that in the way that's both, I think, idiosyncratic and universal.
I really want to be clear about, like, there's so much about the real Detroit that's in this, but there's so much about it that's my version of Detroit and my mythology about Detroit. And so I do like that idea of, you know, it's almost like the opening credits of Game of Thrones where you're going over the map, just like you said, and you can see this is this kingdom over here and that's that kingdom over here. And these people have blonde hair and these people, you know, fly dragons. And that's what I really was trying to capture, that it was like an underworld kingdom in a way, and that it was multifaceted, and there are worlds and gangs and tribes and all kinds of things within it. And, you know, hopefully if we're lucky enough to get more seasons of this show, more of that mythology can come out.
But I think that even in terms of, like, there's being kind of specificity of accents, if somebody's closer to Oakland County, they're going to sound a little more suburban than somebody who's from near the center of the city. And we get all of that in there. And I just think in textual terms, the show is exciting to me because I've never seen anything quite like it before, done by somebody of color with a cast of so many Black actors in it.
I really felt like, I mean, this is what they taught us in theater school. The more specific you get, the more universal it'll be. And, you know, last night I was saying I was having dinner with my producer financier for my film that we're working on. And he was just like, he said to me, older white guy, maybe 70, I'm not sure. I hope I'm not wrong. And he listens to this and is offended. But he was saying that he really enjoyed the show. And then he said, and to be honest, I didn't expect to necessarily. And I, he was like, but I totally got it. I totally got it. And I think that he was like, I understood her point of view, and I laughed out loud and I just got it. And I thought, yeah, that's, I mean, that is in part by design that it's so specific that hopefully everyone has a way into it and will fill in their specific ideas about things. But also just this idea that people don't expect to relate necessarily to things that are Black female driven, I think it's part of my mission to change.
Well, I can only hope you get a second season so you can come back. My guest is Tiara from Detroit, Tiara Kilpatrick. The show is Tiara from Detroit on BET+. I can't thank you enough for doing this. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Detroit City is one of the finest in this world.
Multi-hyphenate and Detroiter Tiara Kilpatrick, who created and stars in the BET Plus series that's itself a hyphenate, the mystery comedy drama show Tiara from Detroit. It's The Treatment.
I'm crazy about that city, and our love is pretty good. When you're in that city, and you're feeling kind of low.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. With The Treat, documentary director Tom Zimney, whose films have taken us behind the curtain with icons such as Springsteen, Stallone, and Presley, on a film that showed him how to be the boss.
I'm Tom Zimney, and this is The Treat. It was a dyslexic kid who could not connect to reading and writing, but at the same time I had all these emotions and all these thoughts and all these feelings that I wanted to get to or just try to express. And I got invited to a screening of a film that I barely had any understanding of what it would be, and it turned out to be a film called Koyaanisqatsi. Koyaanisqatsi. This film had not a single line of dialogue. It was images and music, a score by Philip Glass. And in that, it told me that there was another language, a language that I didn't have to worry about, that I didn't have to struggle with. That was the language of music and film. And two images put together with music could tell a story. It changed my life. So at 18, I bought a video camera, completely obsessed with this film, Koyaanisqatsi, rigged up two VCRs, wanted to figure out this magical act called editing by taking one tape and hitting play and another tape hitting record. Koyaanisqatsi in my heart, I start making films. And the first thing I wanted to tackle was a song I was obsessed with, which was Born in the USA. Born in the USA, I read an essay that was not a song that was pro-America. It was about a Vietnam vet. And I got obsessed reading those lyrics. And I recycled a PBS documentary on Vietnam. And I decided I was going to make my version of Born in the USA and sat in my room all night long. I cross-cut it with a PBS documentary, a Memorial Day parade, and the song. It was my early attempts at telling stories, and for me, the first time I experienced an edit that I made and felt a new meaning when putting the two images together, I felt my place in the world. I felt like this is something that I need to chase, and that I could finally talk to people in some way. performing the magic of editing, falling in love with this new language and this magic trick. And that's something I've been chasing all my life. And I'm most grateful that it turned out to be a job for me later in the space of creativity that I got to work with Bruce Springsteen. But also, really, the most important part of it was that Kariani Scotsi opened up a door of a language, of a way of telling stories with music and film.
Tom Zimney, whose most recent documentary is the film Sly, on the epical documentary Kariani Scotsi. Another film that changed the grammar of the medium holds a special place for director Jonathan Glazer, his treat, and others at the archive, kcrw.com/thetreat. A piece of art or a moment that changes the way you listen or see or feel about creativity, the world, and yourself. Reflections on those influences from some of the most influential minds of many mediums. That's The Treat. This is The Treatment. That's what we call a segue. Produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. We did get help this week, thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Phil Richards. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.